Life Management Science Labs would like to acknowledge that we live and produce this podcast on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people. We'd also like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land of our listeners and our international colleagues. We'd like to thank and pay our respects to the elders, past, present, and emerging. Hello, everyone, and welcome to CeroBoost, the Happiness Science Insights podcast, produced by LMSL, the Life Management Science Labs. We are champions of life management science, providing structured insights informed by science and inspired by practice on key aspects of conscious living. Each week, we bring you scientific and practical insights on each element with the expert knowledge of professionals in the field. I'm your host, Lu Ngo, coming to your ears from NARM, Melbourne, Australia. Let's learn together. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to CeroBoost. We are here weekly to talk about happiness and the science behind it. And today we're going to talk about the power of good friends, social support for happiness. This is my all-time favorite topic. I love my friends so much. But the science says a lot about friendships and perhaps, you know, us on the average, you know, as ordinary people, we might not do a lot of research into this topic. So we have a very special guest today in the studio with us who is sort of living in the past because he's all the way from another place on the planet. And I'll get him to introduce himself in a little bit. So today we have in our studio, Jeffrey Greif, PhD, who is a professor at the University of Maryland School of Social Work. He is the author of 14 books, including four that are co-edited and more than 135 journal articles and book chapters. Thank you so much for being here, Jeff. I know we had a lot of troubles just getting here, but we are finally here and I'm so excited to talk about this topic with you. I would love to get you to share a bit more about your professional journey so far and, you know, some of the key books that you've written because you've written so many.
Well, thank you for having me, first of all, Lou, and I'm thrilled to be here, and I'm thrilled to be here from another continent. I've done a number of books. I've been interested in human relationships, so that kind of frames the work that I've been doing. I've done two books on fathers raising children alone after divorce, a book on mothers who lose custody and the reasons for that. I've done a lot of work, including lecturing in Melbourne on kidnapping when parents divorce and they can't agree about who should be raising the children. One parent may kidnap their child and go into hiding sometimes for years. So I've been doing a lot of work on that. More recently, though, I've been moving into areas that are more applicable to everybody. And that's what makes this topic so important, I think, for us, and so exciting to give me an opportunity to talk about. And that's how I got into doing research on male friendships, men's friendships, adult men's friendships, and a little bit about women's friendships too, as a counterbalance. So I've looked at it from both sides. Then I moved into looking at how couples, mostly heterosexual couples, make friends. And that's a really interesting process too, how people balance their time, how they manage their individual relationships with their partner, with their spouse, and how they manage their friendships with other couples. That is sort of considered a horizontal relationship, moving this way within generations. Then I looked at more recently adult siblings, how we maintain our relationships with our siblings. That's also a horizontal relationship. More recently, I've moved into a 2021 book on in-law relationships, mothers-in-law, daughters-in-law, fathers-in-law, sons-in-law, and how they manage their relationships. And even as we're talking now, I'm working on a new book on interracial marriages, those that happen in the United States, but they have a lot of international implications too. So this is why I've been looking both horizontally within generations, but also vertically across generations, parent-child, grandparent, grandchild kinds of things. So there's a lot to talk about in thinking about how do families move into a position of happiness, but also how do individuals do it and what the family has to do with that.
Yeah. Wow. Your scope of work is really broad. And, you know, some topics are definitely applicable to all of us, like the topic we want to talk about today. I think exploring the angle of male friendships would be very interesting, especially for me, because I don't understand much about the dynamic of male friendships. So, you know, it's good to kind of have perspectives. And I can certainly share a thing or two about female friendships. But yeah, male friendship is something else, I would say. So we'll get to know a bit more about the topic. We'll get you to talk about happiness in a little bit. But for now, we have the first section where we get some recommendations from our guest. And this is called Have You Met Jeffrey? So I'm going to start by asking you a couple of questions about your recommendations or just your favorite things when you hear these words. The first thing is a book. What is a book you would recommend?
Well, I hope you've all read A Catcher in the Rye, which is a great United States America-centric book from the 50s by J.D. Salinger. I revisit it every so often to think about family relationships, about loneliness, about lack of happiness. And I think it's a good place to begin. It's a fairly easy read. Holden Caulfield moves in and out of relationships and is struggling. So I think it's good for us to all think about that.
Yeah, great recommendation. What about a movie?
Movies. Last Saturday, my wife and I rented Days of Wine and Roses, which is a 1962 movie starring Lee Remick and Jack Lemmon. Jack was an Oscar nominee. He did not win. He lost to Gregory Peck, who won the Oscar that year. But it's a fantastically complicated story about alcoholism and how Jack Lemmon is an alcoholic, and he meets and drags Lee Remick into the disease. It's a very tough disease, as we all know. And how in the end, I don't want to spoil the end, but how they figure out what to do at the end there. So that's what is, you know, primarily on my mind at the moment.
Yeah. Thank you. You're currently our podcast guest, but I wonder which podcast you would recommend to our audience.
The podcast that most sticks with me is the one about the 12 Thai boys who were caught in the cave, along with their 27-year-old coach, I believe. And I listened to that with great fascination, great ingenuity, great issues around both the engineering related to getting them out, but also the role of family and community on the outside. So that was just a fabulous podcast.
That's a new thing. The first time I've heard about that on this show, I think. So thank you for that. Who is your famous role model? Or if not a famous person, then who's your personal role model?
My personal role model is the former president of UMBC, University of Maryland, Baltimore County, an African-American named Freeman Hrabowski, with whom I've written two books on academically successful African-American males and academically successful African-American females. He just retired from the job, and he embodies everything that's great about academia.
Awesome. Thank you for sharing that. And final question, what is a course you've completed that left a really strong impact on you?
I took a family therapy externship, or an internship as it was called at the time, at the Philadelphia Child Guidance Clinic, and that was in the 70s. And that was just a fantastic experience for me in understanding working with poor families, working with complicated families, and getting as involved in family therapy, which is what I teach and what frames a lot of the work that I've been doing since then. And I weave those theories into the work that I do, both pro bono, but also in the writing.
Wow, that must have been a really interesting and probably hard to digest kind of course, because you know there's a lot to cover and some topics might be a bit heavier than usual. But yeah, I'm glad it added to your professional journey, and that's why you're here to talk to us today. You know,
there's
so much to cover, and yeah, we'll get to perhaps ask you about other areas of your expertise after we have gone through the main part of this show, where we talk about, you know, the power of good friends. I think this is a topic that's really close to our hearts, because one of the key things I've learned about happiness, you know, since being on this show hosting, is we
really derive a lot of our happiness from our social circles and our good friends. And, you know, that's how, you know, we thrive, even not just in our happiness, but in our well-being. You know, it brings us a sense of happiness, a sense of, you know, being grounded. So before we talk about good friends, I would love to ask you about happiness. I ask all my guests this question and 10 people have 10 different answers. What does happiness mean to you, Jeff?
Well, let's see if I can add an 11th one to you, 11th different answer. It's kind of like friendship. You know, how do we define friendship and what's the connection? How do we maintain connections with others? And how much of our happiness is a reflection of who we see and what we see in other people and how much of it is generated from ourselves? My father was a pessimist in life. And my mother was an optimist. And what resonates for me in sharing that is that my mother always said, well, he's an optimist, he's a pessimist, I'm an optimist. My mother would say, we're each right half the time, but I'm happier. And I think that's a great way to think about it. And some of this is, you know, purely genetic. You tend to wake up in the morning and that can be a genetic gift to you, or the morning looks dark and that could be a genetic gift to you also, maybe one that you have to struggle a little bit more to get out of bed. For me, I can wake up and pop out of bed, and I'm lucky that I inherited more of my mother's genetic makeup than my father's when it comes to happiness. So I think it's also, for me as a social worker, seeing a lot of joy in others. It's a nice way to move through the day and to think about how I feel better from making people or helping people to feel happier and better.
Yeah, definitely. I really love that definition because I've been thinking about that a lot lately, because I think for all of us at all times, we would have some sort of narrative in our head, whatever is happening in our lives. And I found that we are going to feel more of what we pay attention to and the narrative that we tell ourselves. And that is probably in alignment with, you know, the pessimist or the optimist narrative. Because, you know, if you're a pessimist, you're probably just going to pay attention, more of your attention to what's wrong, while the optimist would pay more of their attention to what's going right. And I think it's grounded in the gratitude practice. And being optimistic is probably a trait that can be nurtured. I think it's a very important thing to think about and to talk more about, because I talk to my friends and, you know, some of them are just so grateful all the time, even though lives can be tough sometimes, right? But they just celebrate all the good things. They talk about the good things more than the bad things. And I just really appreciate that, since we're talking about good friends. So yes, you know, that's where I find the great in the good friends.
Well, I think you have, you know, you hit the nail on the head that the narrative that we have in our own heads is so important. Do we look around to prove to ourselves that the world is dark, or do we look around to prove to ourselves that the world is full of light? And I'd rather err on that side than err on the dark side.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just what we pay attention to. It's so important. I really love this definition. Definitely add an 11th kind Yay. Of definition as an 11th guest. Not that we've only had 11, but you know what I mean.
I do.
So next question we always ask as well is, we have this definition from you, which is a unique definition. And from that definition, you probably have some ideas in mind about the misconceptions that people tend to have when it comes to happiness. And also, you know, in your line of work, I'm sure you've been exposed to a lot of different people, lots of different research. So what are some of the biggest misconceptions that you notice when it comes to happiness?
I think the biggest misconception, and it's a theme throughout my work, is to try and get people to understand that nothing is black and white and everything is gray. And throughout the writings that I've done, I weave in three words to try and encapsulate broadly what happens in intimate and less intimate friend relationships. Those three words are affectionate, they're ambivalent, and they're ambiguous, the three A's. So when we think about friends and think about ourselves, go for the joy. Understand that there's a lot of affection here, that affection is a good thing and you want that to grow, but also understand that life is full of ambivalence and ambiguity, that don't expect everything. I shouldn't expect to be affectionate with my wife of 47 years all the time. I should expect some ambivalence, that being a normal part of life, and some ambiguity. And we can talk more specifically about what ambivalence and ambiguity is as we get into some of the work. But I think walking into most things and not expecting everything has to be great, or I have to feel affection for this intimate partner or spouse or family member all the time, is setting us up for failure. I think we need to understand that we have ups and downs with happiness, and those that we interact with have ups and downs with happiness. And if you can frame it more broadly and say, that's natural, don't set yourself up for failure if you think it always has to be a certain way.
Yeah. It's like that flexibility in our thinking as well, right? Because a lot of the time, I think it goes straight back to the narrative. Like, we could easily get stuck in a narrative. This is what I've been noticing a lot, because I've just been, you know, reading up on psychology and just watching a lot of videos in psychology. And I'm like, that is so true. You know, I never really thought about this before. And the more I read up on it, the more interesting it gets. So yeah, I think it's really important for all of us to pay attention to what we pay attention to, you know, and yeah, those are definitely some of the biggest misconceptions that we can address for today. But now let's talk about good friends. I love talking about this topic. I think we are not ever not surrounding ourselves with good friends. You know, we're always striving to, you know, get good friends in our lives, or actively working on our friendship so that we can be good friends ourselves. So what would be some of the quality, or, you know, some of the ways that good friendships can impact our happiness? Or maybe, you know, not so good friendships could also impact our happiness level.
There's a lot of good, epidemiological research that has been done that talks about how people with friends live longer, happier, healthier lives. So I think there certainly is a reason to figure out why we need to get into friendships, and why we need to nurture our friendships, why we need to get them to grow. So with health and longevity, of course, comes more happiness. A healthy person is going to be happier than a person who has an unhealthy stretch in their life. So I think thinking about the social networks that we bring and trying to keep those as wide open as we can. What happens as we age is that you tend to lose your close friends. You tend to believe that you can only be friends with people that you met in high school or college because they knew you then. And you need to keep an open mind about making friends today and for today to be able to move forward with ensuring that you're going to be happier.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's so important because our friends are our social support network. And to me, I think it's, I'm not sure if a lot of the audience can relate to this, but to me, it's extra important because my friends are basically my family. You know, I moved countries, you know, I moved from Vietnam to Australia. I have no friends here. You know, I basically have no friends here when I moved here about more than 5 years ago. And ever since then, I realized how important friends are. And, you know, in that regard, my family is so far away. My friends became my family. And it takes a lot of effort to build and maintain the friendships to make sure that, you know, my level of happiness is maintained. And obviously, you know, with friendships, there are ups and downs, right? This is never going to be like a linear, like, oh, yeah, you're just going to keep growing as friends because your friends' lives might change. For example, for me, I've noticed that a lot of my friends have started to couple up, or, you know, started a family, they settled down, they move away. So it takes even more effort to maintain those friendships. But I do notice that when you put in the effort, it's so rewarding. And it's such a beautiful thing, especially when you can have those friends who you call family in your life.
You're talking about the difference between also the family of origin, which is an obvious term, you know, where we're born, and your family of orientation. You've oriented yourself more towards your friends. That's the family that we build. Now, of course, the family of origin can affect the family of orientation, who we partner with, how we make friends. We learn about friendships very often from our own family. So it's not just a random starting of friendships when you moved here. It's, you know, what did I learn to do or not do from being around my family? How open was the family to letting in other people who were either extended family or friends? Yeah. How were friends talked about in the family? That all sets us up, I believe, not that we're tied to that, but it certainly gives us a propensity for moving towards friendships in a certain way. Do we trust outsiders? That kind of thing.
Oh, yeah, 100%. It all goes back to our childhood, doesn't it? Everything goes back.
We can move from that too. We can do things to correct what happens too.
Of course. I think it's interesting in sharing my story, because when I talked about that, I realized, you know, when I moved away, you know, friends started to become even more important. Like when I was, you know, at home with my family, friends were definitely still really important to me, because people have different values in their lives. And one of my key values would be friendships. So, you know, that to me is interesting, because I realized that when I sort of went into this new phase in life, the importance of friendships increased, even though before that it was already really high. So I wonder, what are some of the other ways that, you know, the importance of friendships in our lives can change, or, you know, it might, you know, either increase or decrease a little bit? Because I know, for example, for a lot of people, and this is what I hear a lot from, you know, some of the grievances that people have is, oh, my best friend is unavailable now that she's in a relationship.
Yep.
Something like that. So I wonder what are some of the, you know, the key stages, or like, you know, probably the transitions in life that would change the dynamic of friendships in our lives.
Yeah. So if we take a bird's eye view of this whole thing, friendships are really important when you're 4, 5, and 6. And in some schools, you are graded on your report card. How well does Lou make friends? Does she move around with her friends well? How well does she play with others?
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's really important when we're 4, 5, and 6, right? But somehow it vanishes from our report card when we get to first, second, third, high school. They don't grade you on that anymore. So something happens to us in our society that we correctly think relationships are really important where we're young, but we don't grade you on that at 14, when it's really hard to be a teenager and you're struggling with a whole bunch of stuff, or 16 or 17, and we can go farther. So across the lifespan, we make very close friends because we're pretty much free to do that at the beginning. And we often hold on to those friends, or we make new friends in college. We make friends in high school if we are happy in high school. We make friends in college, but then if we partner, we then tie ourselves down to that person, that person's family, and that person's friends, while trying to incorporate our own family and our own friends. So, you know, the biggest challenge in life as we grow up is, how do I stay connected to the new person I partnered with, if we're partnered, while still staying connected to my family of origin, and while he, she, or they is still staying connected to their family of origin? So there are a lot of things to balance. And the biggest challenge for couples is time. When do I have time alone to do whatever I want to do, to basket weave? When do I have time with my guy friends? When do I have time with my partner? We'll say, because I'm married to a woman, we'll say I'm married, you know, I'm in a heterosexual relationship. When do she and I have time together? When does she have time for her friends? When do we have time for couple friends? When do we have time for our children and incorporate the family? So that's a really tough balance for a lot of people. How much freedom does one partner have to go out with you and to for her or him to leave their partner or their spouse for 3 hours so you could have a dinner with them? And so we get tied into our family for many, many years. We're focusing on our work if we're working in or outside of the house. And then at some point, if our marriage is stable or our partnership is stable and our children reach 14, they're going to tell us to get out of my life. they're not going to want us around anymore. And if everything else is stable, that's when people begin in their early 50s, maybe, to start looking again for friendships. So they've tied up a lot of time with their family, and all of a sudden their kids don't need them anymore. Maybe their spouse is comfortable, and they have their routines down. All of a sudden, the need for other friends arise just at a time when maybe people are starting to get ill or move away. And they're also being pulled back maybe to take care of their aging parents. So there are a lot of things that are going up and down that make it hard to make friends at a later stage in life if you poured correctly a lot of your time by necessity into your job, into your children, and into your partner.
Yeah, thank you for that. Very insightful. And now let's talk about some of your books, because you know you've shared the bird's eye view, and you know, we've talked a lot about you know, friendships in general. But in your book, Buddy System: Understanding Male Friendships, you interviewed over 400 men. That's a massive number of people, a massive number of men. So, what were some of the key insights or patterns that you discovered about male friendship that? And also their influence on men's happiness, because I think this is something we probably don't talk about very often, especially the angle of men's happiness and in male friendships.
Sure. One of the things to think about is, well, there's some big pictures here. One of them is how do men's and women's friendships differ? But I think we can hold that for a minute. But I was able to group friendships into four different tiers or categories of friendships. So I'll explain those, and I think it'll sort of it'll help to resonate for some people. And these happen to rhyme. You have your must friends, your trust friends, your rust friends, and people that are just friends. So let me start with must friends.
Okay.
Something happens to you, Lou, and you need to call a small cadre, 2, 3, 4 friends within the first 24 hours. You win the lottery, or something very negative happens. You have a group of friends, I'm guessing, as do most people, that they will call immediately. I have to tell so-and-so.
Yes.
Those are our must friends. The next level are your trust friends. Those are people who maybe you see around, you see them at parties, you run into them at dinner, you have great conversations with them. You really feel open to them and they're opening up to you. There's a level of trust, and that's why they're trust friends, but you're not sort of traveling in the same circles. But whenever you see them, you have great times, and maybe you'd call them 5 days later after you won the lottery just to let them know. If you're having a small party, you wouldn't invite them, but if you're having a larger party, you know, maybe we'll add them, but you really like them. Yeah. Those are your trust friends. So they're very important. And that's a larger circle. Then you get into rust friends. Those are the friends you had from when you were young. And they can be must or trust friends, but they're old friends. So when you go to your high school reunion, you fall back into those patterns with those people because you're 17 again. And those are people that you've been friends with for a long time. You may not see them for a number of years. And then you have folks at work or somewhere else that are just friends. You may go out for lunch with them, but you wouldn't have them over to your house necessarily or go over to their house. So those are categories that I think encapsulate a lot of friendships. Now, if you have a lot of those people, your happiness is going to be able to be grown in a lot of different ways. It's not just happiness with your really close, intense friends, but you have learned to expand and reach out and bring in people. People that collect people are always fun to be with, and people that are not good friend collectors are going to have a harder time making friends. So the way that the men described friendship varied from one man to the next. So there's no consensual validation of what is a friend. So I think different people related to happiness are going to have to figure out for themselves what are they looking for in a friendship, and what is the connection between that and happiness? What am I looking for friendship to do for me? Are they supposed to make me happy? Or are they just supposed to be who they are? What's the obligation they have to me?
Yeah. That is a really interesting point. I think it's so tough because, you know, this is like my internal struggle, at least. A lot of the times, right, you would look at happiness and then you would go, I don't want to base my happiness on anybody else. But in the context of friendship, actually, your happiness does come from good friendships. So I think it's like always like a constant battle of where do I find the balance? Because yes, I don't want to be heavily reliant on my friends. But if I'm only basing my happiness on myself rather than my friends, that also doesn't make sense. Because the interaction I have with my friends bring me happiness. So it's kind of like, you know, for me, it's like, okay, where do I find the balance?
And I think the narrative that, going back to the narrative theme again, the narrative that we have is, how do I want to view myself? Do I want to view myself as somebody who goes down the whole rabbit hole with a friend when that friend goes down, or is reaching down to help them up from the rabbit hole while still being on the ground and feeling sad? If something bad happens to a friend, you should feel sad.
Yeah.
So, you know, sadness in relation to bad fortune makes sense. If you didn't feel it, you wouldn't be a good friend. You wouldn't be, you know, empathetic. But I like the view of, I understand you're going down the rabbit hole. I'm going to go down there with you as far as I can go, but I need to also stay up on ground.
Yeah.
So I maintain my own life.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think when we maintain our ground and, you know, we are able to stand above the rabbit hole, we can pull them up with us.
Right.
Otherwise, we're both going down.
And, correct.
You know, misery loves company, and that's not going to be fun for anyone.
No.
So yeah, I think it's really important to be empathetic, but not let that affect your life. Like, that's one of the things that I have to learn, because sometimes, you know, I actually had this conversation with someone, and I was kind of saying, you know, like, I'm really worried about this friend, and, you know, they're really sad, and that's making me kind of sad. And then they're like, why are you so sad about it? Like, you know, like, you're letting it affect you. And I'm like, no, actually not. I'm just empathetic, and I feel the sadness for the, you know, for the situation, but it's not like I'm constantly thinking about it. You know, I feel that so that, you know, I would think about ways I can help them. Not that I'm going to drag myself down right there with them and just sit in sadness, because my life is a lot of different things. And, you know, I have a lot of different friendships, different aspects of my life. So I think it's a thing that a lot of people might misunderstand when it comes to empathy. And in fact, yesterday I was recording this episode on empathy for another show. And, you know, that's kind of the trap when it comes to empathy, and especially in friendship. It's a fine line that you kind of have to maintain, and you have to be really just strong and staying really grounded in where you are and what you want to do. So yeah, I think that's a really good point you made there.
Thank you. And I think you're right there at the right place to struggle. I think that's just a struggle. If our friends are sad, if our children or our parents or siblings are sad, I think it certainly should make us consider sadness and not dismiss it. That we have to join with people. We have to connect with people, and that means sometimes going up and down a little bit, just not as far up or as far down.
Yeah, absolutely. So we've covered one of your books. Now let's talk about another one.
Let me just make one final point about the friendships before
definitely.
We leave. Okay. That is that, and I talk about it in Buddy System, men tend to construct friendships differently than women. So we interviewed 120 women for the Buddy System. And women tend to have face-to-face friendships, while men have shoulder-to-shoulder friendships. So if you're trying to make a friend, you need to be aware of, it may not apply to that friend or to you, but general trends are that men like to get together and do things, where they're facing out, going and watching sports, doing things. It's whereas women feel more comfortable. Obviously, there are exceptions. Sitting down and saying, let's talk face to face. We need to get together and have a glass of wine at this cute new place that opened up. Men don't tend to do that. Men are going to say, I'll meet you at the sports bar and we'll do something, or come over and we'll watch the game. There has to be something else there. So it gets into how men and women look for happiness in friendships and what kind of connections they need to build. Okay, yeah. I just wanted to make that point before we move on.
Yeah, that's an interesting insight for sure. And now let's talk about siblings. That's what I was going to get to, because I think this is also interesting, because I don't have siblings, but I have a lot of friends who have siblings, and the dynamics that they have with their siblings are really different. Some of them are friends with their siblings. Some of them are not. So in your book, Adult Sibling Relationships, you explore the significance of sibling relationships. So how can these relationships affect our happiness, our well-being, and how do they differ from friendships?
Okay, well, it's interesting because a lot of siblings will say that their sibling, a lot of people will say their sibling is their best friend, but it's not everybody. And the majority of siblings, we interviewed 400 siblings about 700 sibling relationships. So they were each talking about having between 1, 2, and 3 siblings in general. There were some extremes. But the general themes that came out were that don't expect, and it goes back to my ambivalent and ambiguous adjectives for relationship. Don't expect these sibling relationships to be these fantastically loving experiences. Expect them to have their ups and downs. 3/4 of our siblings in our study said that they had ups and downs with their siblings across the lifespan. Women tend to take a more central role in the family in building sibling relationships than do men. Older men in particular tend to not take a major role in building relationships with siblings, whereas younger men are more engaged than their older group are. So thinking about how people make friends and how that leads to happiness, having a tough sibling can be a shadow on your life. If you are estranged from a sibling, it can really be upsetting. You can watch your parents struggle. You can watch family events be more difficult because everybody says, why isn't he here? Why isn't she there? So at the end of a lot of relationships, if we go to the extremes, are about 1 out of 6 people were very unhappy with their sibling relationships. While the majority were happy, there were some that were not. And that book is intended to help people understand that this is natural, that you have millions of interactions with your siblings across the lifespan. They are the person you know better than anybody. You live with them longer than your friends and with your parents, unless you make a friend at a very young age and keep them. So it's important to try and figure these relationships out and to be careful about how your sibling relationships might affect your intimate relationships and your friendships. So by sorting these out and not putting too high a standard on your sibling relationships, you might ensure greater happiness and greater contentment. I needed to get back to happiness there.
Yeah, definitely. That is so interesting because I don't have any siblings. So to me, all of this sounds really fascinating. And perhaps, you know, some of the audience might have opinions here because they have siblings and they might agree or disagree. We're not sure, but, you know, it's certainly an interesting topic because lots of my friends have siblings. Some of my colleagues talk about their siblings sometimes. And it's kind of like, you know, sometimes it's like this intense love for their sibling. And sometimes it's like this confusion of, I don't know if I love or hate this person.
Right.
But, you know, certainly the siblings are very important in their lives. And that's what I can notice. I was just kind of like, oh, I wish I had a siblings growing up, but, you know, I didn't have any. So just kind of picking up stories from people is really fun to hear.
Yeah. And of course the research says that only children, tend to, of course, focus more on friendships than do people that have siblings, because you've got a built-in playmate when you're young if you're close enough in age to that person.
Yeah, definitely. So we've covered friendships, we've covered siblings relationships, and I think those are some of the key kinds of, I would say, friendships in our lives. It's interesting that, you know, we can also talk about siblings. But what I do know is all of these relationships now are very different from how they were in the past, especially when it comes to nurturing friendship. And the reason for that is because, you know, even for siblings and for friends, when you move away or when you start to have your own lives, you don't necessarily talk to them in person. And for a lot of these relationships, the contact you have with them would be through social media, which is a very interesting thing that I've noticed recently because I went on a digital detox for 2 months and I got off social media. It was really fun because all I did during that time was texting and calling my friends. I was not interacting with anyone on social media. I felt amazing. But then I was like, oh, well, I need to keep it in touch with the trust circle, you know, the one that you just mentioned, not the must circle, the must circle, I call them, but the trust circle. I kind of had to, you know, be on social media to interact with them. So then I noticed that I just had a lot of reflection during that period. And I was like, you know, social media has changed the dynamic of friendship so much because I really miss the days, you know, the old days when I was really small and all I was excited about was get home from school and call my friends on the phone. We would have an hour-long conversation. My mom would hate that. We would have an hour-long conversation, a two-hour-long conversation. We would talk about homework, life, school, and everything else. And I felt a true sense of connection. But with social media, it feels like friendships have breadcrumbs of information. Like, I'm posting this to let you know, but I'm not going to tell you. Or you're not important enough for me to text you about this or call you about this. And to me, in some ways, that's really good in terms of pointers because you can kind of see who see you as your must circle, right? But same for you. But I think it's interesting how this dynamic has changed because the social support we get would be very different. So sometimes you get that buzz of, okay, you're posting something and then people are responding to that particular message on social media, especially if you're sharing something personal or something that's important as a message, that can show the social support. But most of the time, you don't get that because, you know, what on social media would be the highlight? So, you know, people don't know the full story. So you don't get the support that you actually need. So, yeah, what are your take on that? Because I've talked a lot about this. I'm very passionate about this topic, but what's your take on it?
Well, my take on it is maybe now that because of COVID and with the advent of Zoom, a lot of people feel a lot more comfortable doing social media and getting on Zoom and getting together in groups than they ever would have before. And I think any reluctance to connect on those platforms has now been kind of washed away. We all know we can do FaceTime or get together. My wife gets together with a bunch of her friends now who live out of town. And they all meet once a month and they have an hour or 2 hours together and they are that trust friend group that get together who would not have gotten together if there was not social media available or COVID available or, you know, the horrible side of COVID. But the upside is that people learn how to move into a whole different way of communicating, maybe for better and for worse. But it's provided access and contact for some people, and that can lead to a great reduction in isolation and loneliness. And those are the other side of happiness. You know, people that are lonely and isolated, if they feel lonely and isolated, they're going to have a harder time getting to that happy spot that we want everybody to be with. So people need to go out and make friends in ways that make them feel comfortable, but they shouldn't eschew one certain way of communicating if they think that may lead to something positive.
Yeah, I think it's something to ponder upon because when it comes to virtual friendship as well, you know, that's another area that I find fascinating. It's good to stay in touch with the friends that you can actually meet on social media. So, you know, like your wife, she gets together with her trust circle, you know, thanks to social media, which is great. And I do that with some of my friends in the trust circle too. But I have another kind of friendship completely where it's like completely virtual. And I think a lot of people are going through this stage because, you know, people move away, they start to make friends. Some people make friends entirely on the internet. And, mm-hmm. you know, they have a friendship even though they never meet. And that is also fascinating. But when it comes to happiness, what would be more effective, or are they equally effective? You know, the virtual friendship versus the in-person friendships.
Of course, you know, I'm going to say it depends on the person. It's going to vary greatly from one person to the next and where that person's coming from. If I am immobile and I'm able to get online and see somebody, and I can't hop on the bus or drive someplace to see somebody, that's going to be a great benefit to people that are unable or are in wheelchairs or are too old to travel a lot. So I think it depends upon where you are and the nature of kinds of relationships you want. I just want people to stay open to making friends in different kinds of ways and to let go of some of their old thoughts about how friendships need to be made, because we're living in obviously a very different world that you're talking about now, and there are opportunities, and hopefully these opportunities don't preclude making friendships in the old ways.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's important to be as open-minded as we can. But to me personally, I think it's also very important to make the effort to see friends. And, you know, virtual friendships are important, especially if you have those friends that are so close to your heart, so important to you, but they, you know, because of life have to move away, or you have to move away because of your life, you can still make the effort to stay in touch. I think it's a matter of the effort, to be honest. Like, mm-hmm. you know, the friendship dies when you stop making the effort, right? And for me, yeah. like I just had a 2-hour call with one of my virtual friends the other day after a very long time, because you know, we miss each other, and we used to talk a lot, you know, at least once every 2 weeks on the phone. But because of the nature of her job, she has to move to Costa Rica. We didn't have, you know, the right wow. time zone and setting to kind of talk. So when she moved back to Europe, we were kind of like, okay, let's talk. And, you know, before all of this, we made friends in person. So the history spoke a lot, and you know, it means a lot to me to be able to find such a friend who I connect with so deeply. And it's just so sad to, you know, stop making the effort. So I got to make the effort, and she made the effort too. So yeah, I think to me that was important.
It's interesting. You said something that made me think about, it's more important for women to have frequent contact than it is for men. In the research I did, men could not have communication for a year and pick up right where they left off, whereas women need to do more to keep the friendships going. And that's one of the differences in the research that I talk about in the book, that women need to nurture friendships more than do men, and want to know if a friendship is fading away, what's wrong, what's going on, what did I do, what did she do wrong? Whereas men say, okay, if you're out of here, I'm out of here too, dude, fine, goodbye. That's it. And there were some men admired, you know, some men I interviewed said, I wish my friendships were more like women's. And some women I interviewed said, I wish my friendships were more like men. They're more cut and dry. They're not as much work. So I think there's a lot of differences there. And that's part of how we're socialized as women and men, of course.
Yeah, that's so interesting. But why do you think that is? Why is there such a big difference between male friendships versus female friendships?
Well, I could go back to the cave men and women and say that in the old days, the men went out shoulder to shoulder and had to protect the tribe, protect the, you know, the village or whatever it was at the time from beasts or from other tribes. And so they went out shoulder to shoulder and they were looking out, and women were back taking care of children and looking at each other and needing to figure out things. Men just need to figure out how to survive and how to hunt and how to fight. Women had to do the more thorny work of how do we maintain these relationships while we're waiting, while we're here doing as important work, maintaining the village. So that takes more communication.
That is very interesting. Oh, I love that. So interesting. Okay. So final question in this part, because I'm very conscious of time. What advice would you give to individuals who are struggling to form or maintain meaningful friendships?
It's a very good question, very important question. There are a lot of different factors to it. We could think about, what did you learn about friendships growing up? And is that a message you want to hold on to? So how much is that past there holding you down or pushing you forward? So there's that you have to think about. You have to think about, what is the narrative you want to have about yourself as a person? Do you want to have a narrative of somebody who is friendly and is smiling and inviting friends? Or are you locked into a narrative that is more held back, and that narrative will make it harder to make friends? The obvious, you know, immediate steps are, you know, people don't come to your door, you have to invite them in. So don't wait for friends to come to you. Do things that you like doing, whether it's joining a chess club or running club or a gamers group online. You know, do something that you like to do and do it around other people. Don't be who you're not, but you have to take active steps. So think about who you are, who you were in the past, or what messages you've got in your head about friendships. Think about how you want to look at yourself in the future going forward. And the third item is, take specific steps to get yourself out and about or into areas where you can make more friends. Don't wait for them to come to you. And let go of this notion that you can only be friends with people that you knew when you were seven. You can make new friends today with who you are today, and you'll just have to explain yourself to them a little bit more. Your friends when you were seven know who you are, but you're just going to have to communicate more to the people that you're meeting today, and hope you can grow every new person you meet into a friend.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I love that. Thank you so much. I think it's such an important message to share with people, especially for me as an adult, you know, passionate about making friends. I talk to my friends about this a lot. I'm like, how do we make friends as adults? You know, in the past, it's so easy. You just walk up to another kid and be like, do you want to be friend? And that's it. You know, but now adult friendships are so hard to make. And, you know, in fact, I struggled, because sometimes I would go to a networking event, I meet really like-minded people, and I thought that we were becoming friends, only to find out that, no, they had some sort of other agenda.
Oh,
that was sad. Yeah. And then, you know, got to start from square one again. But it's okay. I think as adults, it's also good to keep an open mind and know that, you know, one person is not going to make or break you know, how you're going to make friends with others, because, you know, people are different. And the important thing is to keep looking, and you'll find good friends. I'm sure of that.
Sounds good. I agree with everything you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
All right. So we've covered a lot of the theoretical aspect of good friendships. Let's talk about something more practical now. And, you know, I'm sure in your line of work and in your own life, you would have done a lot of different things and tried different things to, you know, cultivate and maintain good friendships. So which practice do you personally use to engage in the practice of maintaining good friends?
Some of it is consciously thinking, when I'm talking to somebody, what am I doing? Am I being supportive? Am I listening? Men, at least, and women too, in my research, like people that listen to them, have their back, and who they can trust, and who will also tell it like it is. Now, those are four different things, but the interesting thing there is, telling it like it is and having my back are, in fact, at odds with each other. If I have your back, am I supposed to say, what you're doing is crazy, stop that? Is that having your back, or am I supposed to tell it like it is? So there's this notion that I'm a good my friends can tell it to me like it is. Well, then they may not have your back, or you have to find some way to say, well, they really have my back, but they're going to be dismissive of bad behavior that I do. So, you know, how much are your friends helping you to move out of bad habits while still saying they love you and they support you. So those are things that are often at odds with each other. And some people are afraid to tell people those things. And sometimes friends won't hear what we have to say. And sometimes we're wrong in what we have to say. So there are a lot of things floating around in our heads in terms of trying to maintain those kinds of friendships by being ourselves, but also listening. Men also like people who are at the same level of masculinity as they are. So there are two historic forms of masculinity. There's the warrior who comes in on the horse and saves the damsel in distress. And that's the big athlete, the strong guy, the warrior type. The other masculine model is the silver-tongued bard, the guy who stands below the balcony, the woman's up there, and through his voice and his poetry, he woos her. Those are very different visions of masculinity. The guys who are on the corner singing, very different than the warrior. So thinking about how we incorporate our friends that are similar to us, we tend to go with friends that are same level of masculinity.
Very interesting. Well, I think the practice that you're saying is basically, it's probably something that I thought about the other day, which is, what kind of friends do you need and what kind of friends do you want to be? And that's a conversation that you should have with your friends, you know, because a lot of the times we unknowingly give unsolicited advice, which is exactly something I talked about yesterday when it comes to empathy with one of the guests on another show, which was interesting, right? Because your intention is probably to be a good friend, but you're so passionate about your own point of view that you don't really care about what the other person wants. You know, they probably don't need any advice. They just want to vent.
But yes, absolutely. Very, very true that sometimes it's more about us than about the friend.
Yeah. Friendship has to go both ways. So yeah, you gotta listen. That's been so interesting. What an enlightening conversation. Thank you so much. And the last part that we're going to have before we let you go would be open mic. What would be something that you have been really passionate about lately?
I love the Beatles. And there's a great new opening of photographs that Paul McCartney took, and it's now on display starting the end of June at the National Portrait Gallery in London. I'm going to go there. I have a ticket. I'm going to go and see it. I saw the Beatles live twice. I was I worked in a guitar store in London, and George Harrison's guitar came in, and I touched it. So I'm passionate about anything having to do with the Beatles.
Oh, that must have been surreal, you know, being able to touch his guitar. I'm sure you had the best day ever.
I haven't washed my fingers since, right?
Oh, goodness. Well, you shouldn't have said that. We've just gone through COVID, but okay.
Okay.
Very interesting. Thank you so much for being here and sharing your insights and also sharing a bit more about yourself with our audience. I think it's been really important to have that. And in a way, hopefully our audience nurtures some sort of friendship with you through listening to this conversation.
Thank you, Lou. You've been great. And thank you for sharing about your own friendships.
Yeah, my pleasure. And if our audience would like to find out more about your work, where should they go?
I guess they should just plug in my name to Google or look at me at the University of Maryland School of Social Work and follow me there.
Thank you so much and enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you. You too.
You've been listening to Sarah Boost, the Happiness Science Insights podcast produced by the Happiness Science Labs, a division of LMSL, the Life Management Science Labs. More episodes are available from 10 life management perspectives and can be found by searching LMSL on Apple Podcast, Google Podcast, Spotify, YouTube, and other podcasting apps available on your devices. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate, share, and subscribe to our channel so that other people can find it and we can continue to provide quality content. More of our work can be found on our website at ha.lmsl.net, where you can join our movement. I'm Lu Ngo. Thanks for tuning in.